Chapter 4. Killing at Close Range. I knew that it was up to me, personally, to kill him. Quote, an Israeli paratrooper came face to face with a huge Jordanian during the capture of the old city of Jerusalem in 1967. We looked at each other for half a second, and I knew that it was up to me, personally, to kill him. There was no one else there. The whole thing must have lasted less than a second, but it's printed in my mind like a slow-motion movie. I fired from the hip, and I can still see the bullet splashed against the wall about a meter to his left. I moved the Uzi slowly, slowly it seemed, until I hit him in the body. He slipped to his knees. Then he raised his head with his face terrible, twisted in pain and hate, yes, such hate. I fired again and somehow got him in the head. There was so much blood, I vomited, until the rest of the boys came up. John Keegan and Richard Holmes, soldiers. Close range involves any kill with a projectile weapon from point-blank range extending to mid-range. The key factor in close range is the undeniable certainty of responsibility on the part of the killer. In Vietnam and later in Iraq and Afghanistan, the term personal kill was used to distinguish the act of killing a specific individual with a direct-fire weapon and being absolutely sure of having done it oneself. The vast majority of personal kills and the resultant trauma occur at this range. For analysis purposes, I have divided examples of close-range encounters into those in which the narrator elects to kill and those in which he does not kill. To kill. At close range, the euphoria stage, although brief, fleeting, and not often mentioned, still appears to be experienced in some form by most soldiers. Upon being asked, most of the combat veterans whom I've interviewed will admit to having experienced a brief feeling of elation upon succeeding in killing the enemy. Usually this euphoria stage is almost instantly overwhelmed by the guilt stage as the soldier is faced with the undeniable evidence of what he has done, and the guilt stage is often so strong as to result in physical revulsion and vomiting. When the soldier kills at close range, it is by its very nature an intensely vivid and personal matter. A U.S. Special Forces Green Beret officer described his revulsion during a personal kill while reacting to an ambush in Vietnam. I took two of the men and went around the flank to outflank them and take them out. Well, I got around to the side and pointed my M16 at them, and this person turned around and just stared, and I froze because it was a boy. I would say between the ages of 12 and 14. When he turned at me and looked, all of a sudden, he turned his whole body and pointed his automatic weapon at me. I just opened up, fired the whole 20 rounds right at the kit, and he just laid there. I dropped my weapon and cried. John Keegan and Richard Holmes, soldiers. Author and World War II Marine veteran William Manchester vividly described the same psychological responses to his own close-range kill. I was utterly terrified, petrified, but I knew there had to be a Japanese sniper in a small fishing shack near the shore. He was firing in the other direction at Marines in another battalion, but I knew as soon as he picked off the people there was a window on our side, that he would start picking us off. And there was nobody else to go. And so I ran towards the shack and broke in and found myself in an empty room. There was a door, which meant there was another room, or the sniper was in that, and I just broke that down. I was just absolutely gripped by the fear that this man would expect me and would shoot me. But as it turned out, he was in a sniper harness, and he couldn't turn around fast enough. He was entangled in the harness, so I shot him with a .45, and I felt remorse and shame. I can remember whispering foolishly, "I'm sorry," and then just throwing up. I threw up all over myself. It was a betrayal of what I'd been taught since a child. At this range, the screams and cries of the enemy can be heard, adding greatly to the extent of the trauma experienced by the killer. Major General Frank Richardson told Holmes that it is a touching fact that men dying in battle often call upon their mothers. I've heard them do so in 5 languages. Oftentimes, the death inflicted on the enemy during a close-range kill is not instant, and the killer finds himself in the position of comforting his victim in his last moments. Here we see Harry Stewart, a Ranger and U.S. Army Master Sergeant, the epitome of toughness and professionalism, telling of a remarkable incident that occurred during the Tet Offensive in 1968. All of a sudden, there was a guy firing a pistol right at us. It looked as big as a 175mm howitzer just then. The first round hit the fireman on my left in the chest. The second round hit me in the right arm, although I didn't know it. The third round hit the fireman on my right in the gut. By this time, I had bounced off the wall to my left. I charged the VC, firing my M16. He fell at my feet. He was still alive, but would soon die. I reached down and took the pistol from his hand. I could still see those eyes, looking at me in hate. Later I walked over to take another look at the VC I'd shot. He was still alive and looking at me with those eyes. The flies were beginning to get all over him. I put a blanket over him and rubbed water from my canteen onto his lips. The hard stare started to leave his eyes. He wanted to talk, but was too far gone. I lit a cigarette, took a few puffs, and put it to his lips. He could barely puff. We each had had a few drags, and that hard look had left his eyes before he died. Even when the killer has every motivation to hate and despise his victim, and every reason to quickly depart his close-range kill, he is often riveted, frozen by the magnitude of what he has done. Here, Lieutenant Dieter Dengler, recipient of the Navy Cross, America's second-highest decoration for heroism, and the only U.S. flyer to escape from a Southeast Asian prison camp after being shot down and captured, found himself in just such a situation. Upon securing a weapon and breaking out of prison, Dieter was confronted by one of the sadistic guards who had tormented him. Only 3 feet away, Moron, their nickname for this particular guard, was coming at me full gallop, his machete cocked high over his head. I fired from the hip point-blank into him. The force of the blast hung him in the air, his machete still raised, and then spun him backwards to the ground. There was blood gushing from a huge hole in his back. I stood over him with my mouth open wide, amazed that a single slug could do such damage and mindful of nothing but the horrible looking back. Of all these narratives, it is this emotional reaction that the writer wanted to tell us about. Of all the things that occurred in the months and years of war experienced by these men, the close-range kills quoted here, and all the many throughout this study, appear to be something these veterans wanted to get off their chests. A first sergeant who was a Vietnam Special Forces veteran once put it this way when describing combat to me. When you get up close and personal, he drawled with a cut of chewing tobacco in his cheek. When you can hear him scream and see him die, and hear he spit tobacco for emphasis, it's a bitch. And not to kill. At close range, the resistance to killing an opponent is tremendous. When one looks an opponent in the eyes and know that he is young or old, scared or angry, it is not possible to deny that the individual about to be killed is much like oneself. It is here that many personal narratives of non-killing situations occur. Marshall, Keegan, Holmes, Griffith, virtually all who have studied the matter in depth, agree that such non-participation is apparently very common in mid-range conflict. But in close-range situations, it becomes so remarkable and undeniable that we can find numerous first-person narratives. Keegan and Holmes tell of a group of Americans who jumped into a ditch while under artillery fire in Sicily during World War II. And lo and behold, there were about 5 Germans, and maybe 4 or 5 of us, and we didn't give any thought whatsoever to fighting at first. Then I realized that they had their rifles, and we had ours, and then shells began landing, and we were cowering against the side of the ditch. The Germans were doing the same thing. Then the next thing you know, there was a lull. We took cigarettes out, and we passed them around. We were smoking, and it's a feeling I cannot describe. But it was a feeling that this was not the time to be shooting at one another. They were human beings like us. They were just as scared. Marshall describes a similar situation when Captain Willis, an American company commander leading his unit along a stream bed in Vietnam, was suddenly confronted with a North Vietnamese soldier. Willis came abreast of him, his M16 pointed to the man's chest. They stood not 5 feet apart. The soldier's AK-47 was pointed straight at Willis. The captain vigorously shook his head. The NVA soldier shook his head just as vigorously. It was a truce. Ceasefire. Gentleman's agreement or a deal. The soldier sank back into the darkness, and Willis stumbled on. As men draw this near, it becomes extremely difficult to deny their humanity. Looking in a man's face, seeing his eyes in his fear, eliminate denial. At this range, the interpersonal nature of the killing has shifted. Instead of shooting at a uniform and killing a generalized enemy, now the killer must shoot at a person and kill a specific individual. Most simply cannot or will not do it.